This audio recording is presented by Jews for Judaism. We are dedicated to keeping Jews Jewish. www.jewsforjudaism.ca.
I want to just take a moment to tell you about Jews for Judaism if you're not already familiar with our organization. Jews for Judaism is North America's only full-time counter-missionary organization. We work to counter the efforts of missionaries that are targeting Jews for conversion, cults, and what have you. And the bulk of the work that we do is preventive education. That would be doing programs, lectures, classes, producing tapes, booklets, pamphlets, so that the Jewish community can be inoculated against the missionary and the cult threat. Another aspect of the work that we do is counseling. We spend a lot of time counseling Jews that are involved in various religious pursuits, and our hope is that through some investigative research, they might come to realize that the truth was always in their own backyard. But many people are not familiar with the other aspects of the work we do, and it's our intention that as a result of tonight's program, you'll have a greater appreciation for the various issues that threaten Jewish continuity. And as a result of touching base on some of these issues, you'll have a deeper clarity of the threat that faces our Jewish community, but also you'll have a deeper appreciation for the work that Jews for Judaism is doing to counter these problems. Tonight's speakers represent directors of various Jews for Judaism branches, and I'll just go through the speakers for tonight's program and the topics they'll be speaking on. The first speaker this evening will be Rabbi Ben Sion Kravitz. He'll be speaking on the problem of intermarriage and what can be done. Second topic is missionaries reporting from the front lines. That will be Mark Powers. Mark Powers is the executive director of the Baltimore branch. I failed to mention that Rabbi Ben Sion Kravitz is the founding director of Jews for Judaism International, based in Los Angeles. Our third speaker this evening will be Scott Hillman. He'll be speaking on cults. Are they still a concern? He's based in Washington and also works out of our Baltimore branch. And lastly, spiritual hunger, the lure of Eastern religions. This talk will be given by Rabbi Michael Skoback, who is the educational director and senior counselor for the Toronto branch of Jews for Judaism. I also want to just take a moment to welcome the other members of the Jews for Judaism staff that are visiting us here today. We have Rabbi Perry from Los Angeles. We have Rabbi Graham Finkelstein from Johannesburg, South Africa. We have Shoshana Zakhar, who is from Baltimore, our webmaster, the one who's responsible for our very popular website. I'm sorry? Thank you. Jerry Siegel, who is our director from New York City and also the author of the book, The Jew and the Christian Missionary, probably the most exhaustive book written on the topic in our current day, dealing with the threat of missionaries. We have also in the audience today somebody who we as a Toronto Jewish community, two people who we as a Jewish community should be very appreciative of for the work they have done for Jews for Judaism in both their support as dedicated volunteers now for they're in their eighth year. They are personally responsible today for raising 10% of the budget of Jews for Judaism. That's Jerry and Sandy Genesov. Jerry and Sandy, we really appreciate your help. We have in the audience here today also a very esteemed colleague from Florida who is the executive director of a similar organization as Jews for Judaism. The organization in Florida is Torah Life and Living. And the executive director, Aaron Schwartzbaum, if you could just stand up and be recognized, Aaron, who's very, very dedicated to this work. Thank you for being here tonight, Aaron. Aaron is actually one of these individuals that knows me from the beginnings when we were trying to get Jews for Judaism off the ground, and he was constantly encouraging us to do the efforts, and I hope he's hopping a little nachas tonight to see that we've got ourselves a considerable presence here, not only in Toronto, but in Canada. Anyways, enough with the commercials and the slapping on the back. I hope I didn't leave anybody out. No. Okay, so I would like to introduce our first speaker, as I mentioned, Rabbi Bencion Kravitz. He founded Jews for Judaism International in 1985 in Los Angeles, fighting the missionary threat in Southern California. He is a renowned counter-missionary expert. He is the author of the book that you have been able to access for free this evening, The Jewish Response to Missionaries, Counter-Missionary Handbook. And if you have not received one, please make sure you get one before you leave. It is now probably one of the most popular Jewish books in Jewish publishing history, over 150,000 in print. I'd like to introduce Rabbi Bencion Kravitz.
Thank you very much for that very generous introduction. Julius pointed out to me that I should try to keep my presentation to 20 minutes, something that I'm not used to doing. So I told him I would do it if I could sing a song and at least complete the song, and he said, fine. So here goes. A billion bottles of beer on the wall. A billion bottles of beer. So I must tell you, I'm very pleased to be here. I'm very happy that you are able to see the vast array of resources that Jews for Judaism as an international organization has grown. Together, I think we could easily say that we have made a major impact worldwide on the missionary and cult problem. Speaking just about Los Angeles, I know for an absolute fact that our organization in Los Angeles is already responsible for bringing back from Christianity Jews who were already involved, over 250 Jewish people who were involved in Christianity over the years that we've been doing it. And I know that when you combine the other offices, you'll just start to get a picture of how many people we have actually helped and changed their lives. This evening I've been asked to speak about one of the most painful issues that confronts the Jewish community. That is an issue that really stymies the mind of how to solve it. That's the issue of intermarriage. Intermarriage has grown, the statistics tell us, from somewhere around 6% of the Jewish population after World War II to presently somewhere up to 52%. It is a problem that has gotten so bad that many families have given up hope of figuring out how to prevent it or undo an intermarriage. They've just decided we must go with the flow. I don't believe that that has to be our only response, especially in the fact that evangelical Christian missionaries are using the intermarriage issue as another ingenious way to assimilate Jews into Christianity. Several years ago in Newsweek magazine, when they explored the issue of intermarriage, the writer of the article wrote the following statement, that a young little boy was attending a synagogue preschool. And one day the teacher asked him, "Who do you love?" And this boy, a product of an intermarriage, responded, "I love Jesus." So for those that think that an intermarriage will simply allow people to go in their own paths and that the influences of Christianity will not affect them, that story powerfully points out that that's not the case. Realizing that for many intermarried couples, the issue of faith and belief is something that is probably not on their mind when they get married. It's distant from their thoughts. And those of us in the room that have experienced that issue in our families or friends know that that's a fact. At some point in that relationship, the issue of faith and religion may come to the front of the issues in their marriage. I know a personal case in Los Angeles where a Jewish man who married a non-Jewish woman. He himself was so assimilated that the thought of even suggesting a conversion on her part didn't even enter his mind to suggest it. There was absolutely no interest in faith or religion in his relationship. 10 years into the marriage, very happy couple in terms of non-religious issues, the wife's mother became ill. And while visiting her in the hospital, her memories of her childhood faith became aroused. And over a period of a year, she rediscovered her connection to God and to faith. And I think many of us would say that that's a very positive and good thing for this non-Jewish individual. She prayed with her mother. It gave her strength. When she presented this to her husband, he shrugged his shoulders and said, "Well, it's not for me. I'm not interested." Wanting something cohesive in their marriage, she sought help. She turned to a missionary group called Chosen People Ministries, who had recently published a newsletter with the cover saying, "Intermarriage, a new witnessing frontier." And in the accompanying article to that magazine, just one sentence from it makes a very powerful statement. "We in Chosen People Ministries are glad to provide a spiritual home for intermarried couples and their children, where they can be affirmed and encouraged in their Jewish identities and at the same time of faith in Yeshua," quote, "Jesus the Messiah." Their answer to the spiritual dilemma in an interfaith marriage is to give the couple both. They can be Jewish and Christian simultaneously, the same presentation that's been given by Jews for Jesus and missionaries to you and to your neighbors and to your friends and children. But now it's specifically being targeted at intermarried couples. What is the solution to intermarriage and to this particular problem? Of all the research that has been done, the only suggestion that has proven to be successful is to make the Jewish partner understand what it means to be Jewish. Answering the question of why be Jewish. Because if the person doesn't feel why they should be Jewish and understand being Jewish and feel a spiritual uplifting within their soul for being Jewish, then to tell them not to marry someone who's not Jewish, it means absolutely nothing to them. Recognizing this specific problem with intermarried couples being targeted by missionaries, the Jewish Community Foundation in Los Angeles funded Jews for Judaism with a grant of $35,000 to create a program that would reach out to interfaith couples who have already been married for years. It's already an accepted fact in their lives. And try to reach to them and inoculate them against this missionary argument, and also show them that there is a community that cares for them, that will offer warmth to them. So working with interfaith experts throughout California, we came up with a webpage and a program of lectures, which is our response to intermarriage and interfaith couples. We call the program Two Roads, One Path. And for anyone who wants to see the webpage, they can go to tworoadsonepath.com. It is something different than you've ever experienced before, because it doesn't attack them. It doesn't condemn them. Because if you want to bring them closer, you must bring people closer with warmth. This campaign will be launched in full within the next month, and hopefully will spread to our other centers throughout the world. But to tell you how, in a nutshell, that warmth and caring can help a person, I'll end with a short story. Last November, a Jewish family was referred to our office in Los Angeles by their conservative rabbi. They came to the office and met with me and told me of their dilemma. Their dilemma was that their son, Jonathan, a brilliant student at the University of California in San Diego, a junior, was dating a non-Jewish girl who was a Christian, and according to them, had now started to explore Christianity himself. They were beyond words, the pain that they expressed to me. And they came seeking help. Their rabbi had referred them to Jews for Judaism as the resource that he knew of that could help them. And we figured out a way to make Jonathan feel comfortable coming to meet with me. It was interesting that they told me that one of his favorite pastimes was scuba diving, which happens to be one of mine. So when he finally called up and said, "My parents want me to talk to you," I said, "Oh, about scuba diving?" And he just said, "Scuba diving? How are you certified?" And he listed them off. We had a nice talk about that. And the barriers between us broke down, and we really hit it off very well. He agreed that during winter break he would come to my home and meet with me. He showed up the last week of December to my home and spent 6 hours straight talking to me. We spoke about passages in the Bible that he had been studying, whether in Isaiah, in Daniel. We spoke about the importance of analyzing every nuance of our Bible and how important it is. And then he asked me if I had a personal relationship with God. Did I really feel that God was touching my life? So I told them the story of how when my wife, 22 years ago, was expecting our first child, she went into labor 10 and a half weeks premature. We rushed her to the hospital, and the doctors tried everything to stop the labor, but they couldn't. They came to me 15 hours after we were in the hospital, and they said, "Rabbi Kravitz, there's no way this child can survive. The baby is breached, the umbilical cord is around its neck, the lungs are not developed, we're just going to do a cesarean section to save your wife's life now." So my wife and I sat and we prayed to God for help. And as they took my wife into the operating room, I told her the story of the great Rav, Rabbi Schneur Zalman of Liadi, who on Yom Kippur ran from the synagogue to seek out a woman who was giving birth but didn't have any food or any heat in her home. And he found her and he made a fire and he cooked food and he helped deliver the baby and he saved that baby's life. And I said, "In the merit of that great rabbi, Rabbi Schneur Zalman, perhaps God will also help us." 2 hours later, as they rolled this small child about this big out to the emergency room with tubes in his arm and in nose, we were in shock. The doctor came back into the office, into the waiting room and said, "Rabbi Kravitz, I have to talk to you. I saw his name was Dr. Tenenbaum, and I felt good because he's Jewish." He said, "We don't understand. It's a miracle. Everybody in the emergency room is calling this the miracle baby. We can't explain how it's happening." My first question to the doctor was, "Doctor, what is your Hebrew name?" And I looked at him and he answered back, "My Hebrew name is Schneur Zalman." The exact same name as the rabbi in the story. And I told that story to Jonathan, and he came back the following week for 6 hours. And he was so moved, he went back to San Diego a different person. 3 months passed, and I didn't hear from him. 2 weeks before Passover, I sent him an email. "Jonathan, I miss having contact with you. Maybe you'll come for the Seder." He sends back an email the next day. "Of course I will come. And I have to tell you what happened. Rabbi Kravitz, 2 weeks ago I was in church. And I was on my knees in the church praying. And I was so confused by the issues that I heard from the Christians and from you. I didn't know what to do. I said, God, send me a sign." I got up from my knees, sat down in the pew, and I hear two women speaking behind me. And one turns to the other and says, "I have to tell you about the wonderful Shabbat experience I had at my Jewish neighbor's house." He said, "Rabbi, I was blown away." I said, "You're coming for Pesach?" He said, "Definitely, after that." 2 weeks go by, I call him on the cell phone. "You're still coming?" He says, "Rabbi, I'm definitely coming." I said, "That was an amazing story you told me." He said, "That's not the end." I said, "What's the end of the story?" He says, "Rabbi, I wasn't sure if that was really a sign. And I remembered the story you told me about your son, Schneur Zalman." So I said, "God, send me a more specific sign. Let me meet someone with the same Hebrew name as myself." said, Rabbi, last night I was in an AOL chat room. Someone sent me an instant message and I started speaking with him. He turns out to be Jewish. I type, what is your Hebrew name? He types back, Yosef Pesach. He said, Rabbi, that's my name. He said, that's enough. God answered my prayers, I'm back. He not only broke off his relationship with the non-Jewish girl, he not only gave up his exploration of Christianity, which in fact he had already converted, he is now learning Biblical Hebrew and planning this December to go on the birthright experience to Eretz Yisrael and to be totally immersed in Judaism. This is the message we can give our people. The message of spirituality, of warmth and caring. And with that, individually, one by one, we will help rescue many, many thousands of people. And this is the work that we're doing, and I appreciate your support and help. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Kravitz. I just want everybody to appreciate that it really is a limited amount of time that we have for each of our speakers tonight to elaborate on these issues. So don't be too concerned. There'll be plenty of time afterwards for questions and answers. And the leading dignitaries are very happy to stay till as late as is necessary to answer your questions. Our second speaker for the evening is Mark Powers. He is the executive director of the Baltimore branch as well as the national director of Jews for Judaism. He's got many years of experience dealing with the problem of missionaries and cults facing our Jewish community. And I'm going to ask Mark to come and speak on missionaries, reporting from the front lines, and what Jews for Judaism is doing about it.
Thank you, Julius. Like Rabbi Kravitz, I too have a problem with speaking for only 20 minutes. But I'm not going to sing, thank God. But I have an even bigger problem, and that is standing in one spot. Because I'm the proverbial wandering Jew. I hate podiums. I hate microphones. I'd much rather be out there with you, which is the way I normally conduct my programs. However, for the sake of the video cameras this evening, I'm stationary. So if I look like I'm having a problem, that's why. After that inspiring story by Rabbi Kravitz, I get to be the wet blanket. It has fallen to me to discuss the growth of the missionary problem around the world, reporting from the front lines. And I guess the reason that they gave me this particular topic is because of my activities worldwide. I'm not only in the United States, occasionally in Canada, but also in many, many countries around the world. When we look at the missionary problem, this problem, as we know it today, is really about 50-some-odd years old in its present form. That is, taking Christianity, dressing it up to look Jewish, and presenting it to the Jewish community. Now, I don't think I would surprise anybody here if I told you that Christians have always wanted Jews to become Christian. Come in. I suspect it's a sign of, let me think on that. So, while Christians have always wanted Jews to become Christian, the method that they're using today, groups like Jews for Jesus, taking Christianity, dressing it up to look Jewish, calling their pastors, rabbis, their congregations, synagogues, wrapping themselves in talesim, singing Hebrew songs, and telling the Jewish community that it's the most Jewish thing in the world to believe in Yeshua or Jesus. That methodology is only about 50 years old. But that methodology has worked perhaps far beyond their wildest dreams. We frequently hear that they've converted more Jews in the past 19 years than they have in the past 19 centuries. It's not clear as to who originally came up with that quote, us or them, but they love to quote it, and I don't have any problem quoting it back, because it's probably very, very true. But this missionary movement, which started primarily in North America, and primarily in the United States, has now been exported all over the world. In 1978, there were approximately 20 Hebrew Christian congregations in North America. Today, as we look around, there are over 400 Hebrew Christian congregations in North America alone. There are over 100 of these congregations in Eretz Yisrael. They produced a book in 1999, Facts and Myths About the Messianic Congregations in Israel. And this book lists congregation after congregation. And we know that there are even more there now. That is, by the way, combined, if you combine the number of conservative and reform congregations in Israel, that far exceeds the number there. And then we turn to the former Soviet Union. The former Soviet Union has become a magnet for the missionaries. When the gates opened up, the missionaries flooded in. We have been using a figure of somewhere around 38 to 50 Hebrew Christian congregations in the FSU, but unfortunately that number is wrong, dead wrong. I came back from Moscow in May, where I had the opportunity to present a program on the missionaries to leaders of 40 different Jewish communities around the FSU, and we did a survey. There are over 100 congregations in the Ukraine alone. We estimate that there may be another 75 to 150 congregations in the rest of the FSU. The number is outstanding, unbelievable, and they are growing by leaps and bounds. Christian missionaries are literally tripping over themselves to get to Russian Jews. And while they are increasing the numbers of the congregations in the FSU, they are not ignoring Russian Jews wherever they may be, whether it's here in Toronto, in the United States, and particularly in Eretz Yisrael. They're using whatever method they can possibly devise to reach out and ensnare the Russian Jews in their programs. And they're succeeding. In fact, the largest number of the Hebrew Christian congregations in Eretz Yisrael are made up of former Russian Jews. But this is a worldwide problem, and it's a problem that, as I indicated, has been exported from primarily the United States. The United States gave all sorts of wonderful things to the world. This is not one of them. We've noticed an increase in South America, which seems to be the next target for the missionary groups. And in fact, we are tracking over 900 U.S.-based and North American-based missionary groups that have as their agenda the same agenda as Jews for Jesus. And when you look at the response of the Jewish community, it pales in comparison. These groups are spending big dollars as well. Last year, Jews for Jesus had a budget of somewhere between $12 and $13 million. That's American. You're going to have to help me with Canadian. I'm sorry. But Jews for Jesus is one group out of over 900 that we're aware of. Chosen People Ministries, over $7 million. Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry, $5 million. And by the time we finish adding up all of the money that these groups are spending in their efforts to convert Jews, we estimate that each year they're putting forth $270 million in that effort. And figure it out. What's the price of a Jew? In 1978, we estimated that there were maybe 10,000 Jews involved in this movement. Today, that number is over 250,000. So they're succeeding. And when we look at that, and when we look at the response of the Jewish community, whether it's from Jews for Judaism or Torah Life and Living, and believe me, Aaron knows that there are few groups out there that are working to try and combat the efforts of these groups, it seems almost insurmountable. It seems extremely frustrating. And if I can, I'd like to tell you a short story. Seems that there was this little boy who lived by the sea, and he heard that the following day there was going to be an extremely low tide. And he knew that when the tide goes out, that the starfish becomes stranded on the beach. And this little boy loved starfish. And he wanted to do something for these starfish. So he got up real early the next morning. He goes down to the beach. And as he starts to walk along, he sees a starfish. He picks it up and he throws it into the water. And he walks a little bit further. He sees another starfish. He picks it up and he throws it into the water. And there's a man watching this little boy as he's walking down the beach, picking up starfish and throwing them into the water. And the man walks over to him and he says, "What are you doing?" And the little boy explains about the low tide. And the man says, "I can't believe you're doing that. I mean, just look down the beach in this direction. Look at all the starfish. And then turn around and look at all the starfish down the beach in this direction. You can't possibly, even if you work all day, you can't possibly make a difference." Little boy thinks about it. Scratches his head. And he reaches down and picks up a starfish and throws it into the water. And he turns to the man and he says, "I made a difference to that one." And so Jews for Judaism, in spite of what seems like overwhelming odds, we continue to make a difference as we reach out to the people who are ensnared by these missionary groups. But even before they become ensnared, the programs that Jews for Judaism has developed, the educational preventive programs that we have taken around the country and around the world, will be meeting, for example, in August with leaders of Hillel, over 200 leaders of Hillel from across the former Soviet Union. Rabbi Kravitz, Rabbi Skobach, myself, have been throughout South Africa. Rabbi Skobach and Rabbi Kravitz have been to Australia. And we've been numerous times to Eretz Yisrael to do preventive programming to let the Jewish community know that there is a problem out there. Many people don't believe that this is a problem until it hits them. Well, I can assure you that with the growth rate in this movement, very, very shortly, there is going to be very few families out there who will not be touched by this problem. And we want to see if there's something that we can do to prevent it, to prevent more heartache for families in the Jewish community. We've introduced some rather innovative programs. In the Baltimore office, we developed a program called CPR for the Jewish soul, Community Prevention and Response, in which we enter into a Jewish community for a week to 2 weeks, and we do extensive programming throughout the entire community, not just one lecture, and not in just one place, but in every segment of the Jewish community, so that this message that there is a Jewish response that there is a good reason why for the past 2,000 years Jews have said no to Jesus, that information gets to every segment of the Jewish community. And the program has been very, very well received across the United States and even in South Africa. We'll be introducing this fall a program that we call JTTV, modeled after MTV. It's our outreach to Jewish youth on a, I guess, kind of a hip way of reaching the youth, something that hopefully they can connect with. And through cyberspace and our extensive website and the new website at JTTV, we connect with Jewish town meetings, some of them held in conjunction with the CPR program, that kids in their teens, prior to their reaching college, can relate to, with information that they can relate to, something that is speaking to them, something that hopefully will be useful to them and hopefully will keep them connected to the Jewish community. And of course, Jews for Judaism has been at the forefront of providing material in Russian around the world to combat the missionaries. The booklet that you picked up outside, Jewish Responses to the Missionaries, is also available in Russian. We also have Michael Skobak's take and the only video on this subject in the Russian language, and that information has been made available worldwide. There's a cute little story about the first time that Rabbi Skobak went to Russia. And this was after his tape had received rather wide distribution there. And he was doing a program for some people in Moscow, and when he was introduced, several people got up and complained and screamed rather loudly, "That's not Rabbi Skobak!" And of course we were a little confused because we've known Michael for many years. But it seems that this particular tape had made its way to some of the far reaches of the former Soviet Union, and the person that we had record the tape, the translation of it, was female. And so they were expecting a female Rabbi Skobak. Fortunately, we were able to convince them that this was the real item, and his reputation has spread since then, in spite of the fact that the tape is recorded by somebody who's female. In addition to the efforts that Jews for Judaism is making, there are efforts that you as a community can make, because, quite honestly, we can't do this alone. We need your help. As you can see from the people that Julius introduced, there are a few of us. And clearly, not enough to go around. In spite of the fact that we have offices across the U.S., Canada, South Africa, and a task force in Australia, when we look at just one of those groups, remember Jews for Jesus? I'm sure you've heard of them. Jews for Jesus has a full-time staff of over 150 people. And that's just one group. So we need your help. In fact, all of you need to be Jews for Judaism. All of you need to get the message out that there are organizations out there that can help in response to the Jewish communities. But even more than that, repeatedly when we ask people how they got involved or why they got involved, one of the answers that ranks fairly high up there is because they made an effort to connect to the Jewish community, but they found the Jewish community too cold, too distant, unfriendly, not welcoming. And I know that it's not happening in your synagogue or your neighborhood, but I can tell you that unfortunately this is a reputation that the Jewish community around the world has. And it's something that we, each one of us, can do something about. I had the opportunity to take my son to a small private college in New England when we were looking for school for him, and we stepped into a synagogue for Monday davening, And the place was jam-packed. There must have been 12, maybe 13 people there. And at the end of davening, before we had even put away our tefillin, the place emptied out. And not one person, not one single person, said one word to either one of us. And I can tell you it's been a tremendous experience here in Toronto the last 2 days, because in the two synagogues that we were in, just about everybody came over to ask us who we were, what we were doing, and to welcome us. But we need to extend that effort throughout the entire Jewish community to make the Jewish community a warm, welcoming, friendly place, a place where Jews want to be, a place where Jews feel welcome and at home. Because I can guarantee you that if we don't do it, the missionaries will. It's just something very small, but it's a start. It's something that each and every one of you can do to help in this effort to get the word out that the Jewish community is a place for Jews, and that Jews for Judaism is a place that you can go for Jewish answers to the information, the misinformation, that the missionaries are spreading. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Mark. You know, Mr. Powers alluded to a very, very serious problem. I just want to throw a question out to the audience to drive the point home. A lot of times when we do these presentations to Jewish audiences, there's a lot of skepticism. There's a big question mark over people's heads. And the question is it really such a problem? Are you really, really giving us the right figures? So I thought I'd try a quick experiment in this very short break here and ask you to verify for us how big a problem this is. I'm going to ask for a show of hands. And I predict at least 10 hands will go up. We have about 100 people here. 10 hands are going to go up, I feel. This isn't prophecy. This is statistics. How many of you here today know of somebody who is Jewish and believes in Jesus? Hands up. I just want to see the hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay. 12. There we go. The reason I did this is statistically we have found in Canada every time we ask that question, regardless of the size of the audience, 10% of all Jewish audiences know of somebody who's Jewish and believes in Jesus. To show you how frightening the problem is, we're in Canada. We're a generation behind the U.S. When we ask this question in America, 25% of the hands go up. We have a problem. But the problem goes beyond missionaries. Our next speaker, Scott Hillman, works in conjunction with the Jews for Judaism office in Washington and in Baltimore. He's going to speak on cults. Are they still a concern? Scott?
Well, following our international director and our founding director is always a wonderful place to be. And just as Mark says, tying me down to a lectern is a very hard thing. I'm the one they get to jump around and do the teamwork and really get out there and work the crowd. So you'll have to excuse me if I'm not exactly centered for the cameras and for the video. The question in front of us is cults. Are they still a concern? I can do it very quickly, save us a lot of time. Yes. End of statement, because you have to understand something. You're all here tonight. And I expect that when you got up this morning, you spent the day talking with people, listening to things on the radio or the television, maybe reading newspaper. Maybe you kind of shared an interest with someone, whether it be politics, or maybe you had an idea for a new business, or maybe you tried to figure out how you're going to take care of your health, or get prosperous, or maybe find something special to do with your life. Maybe you wanted to really get into your spirituality. You were set up to find meaning. In every one of those cases, that makes you a perfect target. You're all set to join a cult. Because you have to understand something. Joining a cult... yes. Joining a cult isn't what actually occurs. You're recruited. And the way you're recruited... very simple. You have a relationship with someone, and you have a desire to do something with your life. That's all it takes for you to be recruited. So anyone you know who says, oh, I'm never going to be recruited into a cult, not me, I know too much. I already got it all figured out. They're actually the best recruits. And they're the ones who fall for it first. Now, I want to get quite specific here, because whenever people read about cults or hear about cults, it's always a scare word. A lot of people like to say, that group over there is a cult, not my group. I'm not involved with that. I could never become involved with that. Sorry, it doesn't work that way. When Jews for Judaism goes out and talks about cults, we're talking about something very specific. Because really, if you look at the definitions of cults, you're talking about something that has been abused. The press constantly likes to refer to any group that's a little different as a cult. When people are trying to set their enemies up, they always say, oh, that's a cultic group. That's why we're very careful when we talk about groups. There is a very specific understanding. I mean, if you were to open up Webster's Dictionary, look up the word cult, you can have 5 or 6 definitions. And you know what? Most of them involve very basic things. You would be able to say that the Boy Scouts or the Girl Scouts are a cult. You have that in Canada, right? Something like that. The Scouts are a cult. Sorry. You could say that the Marines or your Army is a cult. Because they would fit certain definitions. In Webster's, it says, a religion that is considered or regarded as unorthodox or spurious. Okay. Or a system for the cure of a disease based on dogmas or tenets or principles set forth by someone who is ready to put it forth to the exclusion of any scientific evidence. That's a cult. Or showing a great or obsessive devotion or dedication to some person, idea, or thing. Well, how many people do we know that don't get enamored of some idea or person or thing? Ah, that's a cult. We go a little step further. And the reason I do this, and I do this with all the audiences, so you understand what we're talking about. When we use the word cult, we're talking about something that's destructive. And I want you to also know that when you talk about a cult, you aren't just talking about that one individual who gets involved. You're talking about the family, the friends, and the general community as well. Because a cult doesn't just pick off one person when it does recruitment. So when we talk about cults, we talk about the totalist type. Very specific words. Actually, the definition that we use is taken from the American Psychiatric Association. They did a task force. Because you're talking about deceptive and indirect techniques of persuasion and control. That's the key here. Any group that isn't forthcoming with you, anytime you ask a question, there's a problem. Red flags should shoot up immediately. If you ask a question, they say, oh, don't worry, that's not important right now. We'll get to that later. And they don't get to it when you think later is, and you can't convince them that you really want an answer, you've got a red flag. You really have to pay attention. But if that group or movement exhibits a great devotion or excessive obsession to that person, idea, or thing, and this is the key, it employs unethically manipulative, and that means the deceptive and indirect, that's the key, techniques of persuasion and control, then we have a problem here. But you know what? People don't realize this until they see it in the news. Cults aren't a problem. Unless, of course, they just killed 900 people down in South America, then it's a problem. Or people take their lives, Heaven's Gate, or someone blows up something, or releases nerve gas on a subway, then it's cults a problem. It's not the way it works anymore. The experts in the field talk about the fact that in North America alone, there are probably about 5,000 economic, political, and religious cults operating. And they have approximately 2.5 million people as members, but it's affecting about 20 million people. This is just North America. The cult problem is so prevalent that the chances of a family member joining a cult are greater than that of a family member catching chickenpox. I like to put it in that term because, you know, statistics are a pain in the neck. You all have family and friends. You know about catching chickenpox. It's more likely you're going to lose someone to a cult than you are them catching chickenpox. And that was, Dr. Paul Martin said this a short while ago. He runs a rehabilitation center for ex-cult members. He knows what he's talking about. The problem is that all of these dangers are growing. The fact that we don't see it is because when we all got worried about it back in the 70s, it was a big thing because we saw it on the streets. We saw it on the college campuses. We were concerned that our youth were getting caught up in it. But it's changed. The cults have changed. They've gone corporate. Anybody out here a single practitioner? Whether it be a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer? You probably get solicited for management companies. I can help your business. We can help your business. Come to this seminar. Come to that seminar. A lot of those are front groups. Or you decided, you know what? I want to really get into my own business. I want to set something up for me. Yeah, I think multi-level marketing might be my cup of tea. I'm going to get into some sales. A lot of those groups are cult fronts. Or maybe, you know what? I'm having some problems in my relationships. I think I'm going to join some sort of a psychotherapy group, a group awareness therapy. I'm going to go out and I'm going to really get into things and try to understand my feelings and what it means to be me and how I should relate to other people. Some of those groups are very helpful. Others are going to suck you right in. Or maybe you've decided, hey, you know what? Spirituality I'm dealing with now, Shul's kind of nice, but I'm not really getting much out of it. I think I want to go into some mysticism. I think I want to really get into some ancient texts and really deal with what it means. And I want some prosperity brought into my life. I want to get healthy. And that I have this promise, I understand from all this wonderful stuff I'm reading, that all I have to do is get into ancient texts and I'm going to be okay. Or maybe you've decided, you know what, that moon out there, it comes and goes, and there's some sort of a cycle working here. And there's a group that kind of meets out in the woods and looks at the moon. Maybe I'm going to go sit out there and meditate a bit. Some of these groups are very legitimate. Many of them are not. But the thing is, people are getting caught up in this every single day. And as I said in the first place, why do we call it a cult? And what's the effect it's having on us and the Jewish community? And what can we do about it? Very simple. We call it a cult because they are not direct when you ask the question. Many of these groups require you to sign up for their seminars before you can get any information about what's going to go on at the seminar. When you show up, you'll know what's going on. But you have to pre-register and give them a lot of information first, along with, of course, your major cash contribution. Others say, you know, come take this series of courses at X number of dollars, and we promise you by the end of it, you will find prosperity. But they don't tell you what the steps are going to be, what the program's going to be, what the qualifications of the people are. What we're saying is, be a good spiritual consumer. Get out there and know what you're buying. Because when you don't, you run into troubles. And we're talking all across the board. In the last 4 or 5 months alone, number of cult cases that come through my office are tremendous. And the way they affect the family is even worse. A family had a child who was having difficulties, got them to a proper psychiatrist, trying to deal with a drug problem and some psychological problems went along with it. The psychiatrist felt they needed a resident treatment program. And you know what? Opened up the file, looked through a couple of things that had been sent to her, and said, this is the one. It's a good program. It's got all these wonderful awards given to it, et cetera, et cetera. We think that that's where your son should go. They pulled a few strings. They got him in. No problem. After the fact, we get a call. This is within the first couple of days that the boy's there. Why? Because this happened to have been an observant child, and they wouldn't give him kosher or vegetarian food, at least, at the place. He was getting a hassle, so he called home. He found a way to get to a phone, which was interesting, but I'm not going to go into that. And he made the call and said, something's wrong here. So the psychiatrist had enough sense to call us, We recognized, unfortunately, the group immediately, the place it had been sent. And it was a front for a cult. A very large cult. And I'll leave it at that. But the point is that the psychiatrist didn't know. She had been solicited, just as psychiatrists all across the country, all across North America, are solicited because this is one of the larger residential treatment programs. They have some success, but the bigger success that they have is moving the people right into the cult. The statistics are very, very somber, and the way that people get involved are very straightforward. They're searching for meaning. They're looking for something special to do with their life, or they're looking to get rich quick, or they're looking to improve the business they have, or the practice they have. In each of those cases, people get sucked in because they shut down their critical thinking skills. One of the most important things that we have is a brain. And the minute we say, you know what, this looks good, I'm just going to buy it. How many of you watch infomercials just for the fun of it? How many of you bought something from an infomercial? Okay. You don't want to admit it. This is all marketing. We've talked about intermarriage. We've talked about missionaries. They also, and the missionaries capitalize on many of the techniques. The missionary groups, though, can be cultic. They are not cults, per se. Some of them do develop into cults, individual groupings. But there is a difference between the missionaries and the cults that we deal with. And Jews for Judaism has been dealing with it. We are on the front lines in the Jewish community and also non-Jewish community. We work interfaith on the cult problem because it's a societal problem, and it's a big one. We've developed certain programs in Canada. You have Cultivating. It's a worldwide program. Rabbi Spobak runs that specifically for training seminars because education is one of our key things. And as I said before, critical thinking, which as Jews we know, we've never been asked to check our brains at the door. Asking questions is part and parcel of what we are. We are so chutzpahdik, we argue with God. So we shouldn't ask a few questions of the group that we're joining? Come on. The key here is getting the education and realizing when you're in the situation. And if you feel that your questions aren't being answered in the situation, doing something about it. I go around to colleges and do a program called Cults 101, where we go through not only the definition, but the history. And then we go through the techniques and what are the actual characteristics, such as that charismatic leadership and mind control techniques and those things that occur within a group, the us versus them, right? We're okay, they're the ones who aren't, that occur within these closed groups. It's something that's very important because people have stopped thinking. You know, Charlie Chan used to say, a parachute is like a mind, right? It only works when it's open. But a philosopher in the last century said, an open mind is wonderful, but you can't afford to allow your brains to fall out. Both the cults and the missionaries capitalize on this. The fact that we don't necessarily ask questions, the fact that we have certain responses that we do automatically, especially to someone in authority. And authority just is the authority that we grant them. Whether it be someone who comes to speak, and you know, you have that question, and you heard the lecture, and they went into a Q&A, and you just never asked a question of them. That happens in many situations. You just said that people don't like to admit it when they've made a mistake. Yeah, but once we're honest with ourselves, then we can feel comfortable in asking the questions of somebody else. Jews for Judaism is part of both its CPR program and JTTV, and as part of its curricular programs that go forth for teachers. Educating the educators is very important, because as you see, there are just a few of us. But once we can educate the educators, they can educate the communities, and that's very important. So that's how we spend our time in proactive education. And then, of course, the counseling. The counseling to individuals and the support for families and communities in many cases. Because these groups don't just come in and take up residence and go after just that one family down the block. Once they get that one family is set to start up with everyone else in the neighborhood. So, as Mark said earlier, you're the eyes and ears out there. you see a group that's starting to act in a specific way, or if members of your community are starting to go into a certain path that, you know what, there are some questions on, and they don't quite have the answers, or they don't quite understand what the group's about, or, you know, the group has some questionable practices, get out there and ask the questions. Call us up. We'll be happy to help you ask the questions. But the thing is to ask them and to get answers. Because that's how you respond to a cult that's in your midst. Through information and exposure. Through dealing with it in a straightforward fashion. Not by saying, you know what, it's a free country. If that's what they want to hold by, let them hold by it. Because if they're straightforward about it, absolutely. Everyone's entitled to their opinion. Everyone's entitled to their way of life. But when it's done through deception, it's not fair to anybody. It's not fair to the individual, the family, or the community. And that's why we're here to help, and we welcome your help in dealing with it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Scott. You know, he closed off by saying, we're here to help. When you need help and it's an emergency, what do you dial? 911. Jews for Judaism has been called the 911 for Jewish survival. We get calls so many times for people who are unfortunately involved in cults, Jews involved in missionaries. We have people calling us up with intermarriage problems. But they call us because there are so few agencies in the Jewish community that have the expertise to deal with these problems. One such expert who has close to 30 years' experience in the field is Rabbi Michael Skobach. Not only has he worked with dealing with the problem of missionaries as they confront the Jewish community, not only has he worked intensively in understanding deceptive mind control by cult groups, he also has worked very deeply in understanding what it is that fills the spiritual hunger of the Jew. His next talk, the next talk by Rabbi Michael Skobach, the Education Director for Jews for Judaism and our Senior Counselor, is entitled Spiritual Hunger, the Lure of Eastern Religions.
I have no problem with podiums. I'm a tree hugger. I'm going to grab onto this thing for dear life. I think after focusing so much of our efforts for years with the concern that we had for Jewish people being lost to churches, we began to realize that that wasn't the only place Jews were ending up. When I first came to Toronto about 10 years ago, I was working as the Jewish chaplain at the University of Toronto. And one of my colleagues, the Hindu chaplain, invited me to speak at his temple on a Sunday morning downtown in Toronto. And I decided I would go because I thought maybe I would meet one or two Jewish people there. I showed up at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I must tell you, I've been in this line of work for a long time. I'm rarely shocked. But this Hindu temple in downtown Toronto was crawling with Jews. I was completely stunned. And since that point, I've been trying to understand the dimensions of this phenomenon and to understand really what lies at the heart of it. Some of you might know that today, as we speak here, about one half of all the Israelis who finish their army service will go for extended trips to the Far East, India, Nepal, Thailand, for up to a year, and many of them to explore the spiritual treasures of the East, sampling of the ashrams, the gurus, the yoga practice. When my wife and I went to India several years ago to run Passover Seders, we were completely taken aback by the fact that almost all the signs on the street in the neighborhood we were staying in New Delhi were written in Hebrew. The amount of Hebrew we heard spoken in the street made us pinch ourselves to wonder if maybe we weren't in Tel Aviv. And today, if you want to attend the largest Seder in the world, it takes place not in Israel or in New York, but in Kathmandu, Nepal, where every year over 1,300 Jewish people are there not at their Jewish homes, but celebrating Passover. A number of years ago, I met a woman in Chicago who was a convert to Judaism named Diane. And she was explaining to me her genesis, her story, how she ended up as a Jew. She came from very, very far away, from a Midwestern family, not a Jew in her area. And she told me she became a spiritual seeker. And she traveled all over the world to different ashrams, different spiritual centers, learning meditation and yoga and going to different gurus. And she told me the one thing that was constant no matter where she went was that sometimes half the people at these retreats were Jewish. And she began to realize that there must be something very special about these Jewish people. They must be very spiritual people if they're so interested in pursuing these kind of spiritual paths. And meeting all those Jewish people, ironically, pursuing non-Jewish spiritual paths is what piqued her curiosity and led her, ultimately, to seek the path of Judaism. It's now estimated that about 25% of all of the people practicing Buddhism in North America come from a Jewish background. And not just the practitioners, but the amazing thing is that the leadership and the teachers are phenomenally high in terms of its Jewish representation. Pick up any Buddhist magazine, Tricycle magazine, and Buddhism Today, the number of Goldsteins and Goldbergs and Bluersteins is phenomenal. The people who brought Vipassana meditation to North America were four Jewish people. In Toronto here, one of the leaders of the Sikh community, often appearing on television, is Hari Nam Singh Khalsa, who grew up about 50 years ago downtown in the Kensington Market. His name is David Friedman. If you get some of the leading books today on Buddhism, Lama Surya Das, a nice Jewish boy named Jeffrey Miller from Long Island, one of the leading Hindu lights in the world today, Baba Ram Das is Richard Alpert, and the list goes on and on and on. The irony, the sad irony, is that so much of what they are finding in the East, and so much of what they're attracted to in the East, exists within Judaism. A number of years ago, I picked up a thin book written by one of the great teachers today of mindfulness practice, a South Vietnamese Buddhist monk named Thich Nhat Hanh. The book is called Present Moment, Wonderful Moment, and it presents a series of mindfulness meditations to deal with daily life. They call these gathas. And if you open this thin book, there's a gatha for waking up in the morning, and a gatha for going to the bathroom, and a gatha for washing your hands, and there's a gatha for eating, and a gatha for getting dressed. And if you were to read this book and have a little bit of Jewish sensitivity, you might think that he stole this from a Jewish prayer book. This is something which is not exclusively in the domain of Buddhism. Sadly, though, so many of us don't appreciate the fact that the blessings that we say are there for our spiritual growth. Buddhists in North America and probably throughout the world look forward to the highlight of their life is going on retreat. They save their money. They wait. They might wait months or a year so they can go on a spiritual retreat to get away from their everyday mundane distractions, to be able to go off away from the world, focus on their inner lives. And so many Jewish people are caught up in this cycle of waiting for that retreat. They're going to get to go on and spend 2 or 3 days away from their jobs, be able to focus on themselves, spend $1,000 for it, and we have it every 7 days. It's our Shabbos. We Jews have a spiritual retreat that we are to take every week, and we don't appreciate it. For us, Shabbos becomes a day to fall asleep. And we don't appreciate the fact that it's a day to focus on our internal spiritual growth. So many Jewish people are attracted to the East because of the meditation practices that are offered. I attended a conference in New York a few years ago on Jewish meditation. There were 1,000 Jewish people at this conference. And they were asked, how many of you at this conference ever practiced an Eastern form of meditation. Every hand went up. People had done TM, or Zen, or Vipassana, or Tibetan meditation. The same group was asked, how many people here ever practiced a Jewish meditation? Not one hand was raised. How tragic it is. These people are not aware of the fact that Jewish meditation is as old as the Bible. It's an intrinsic part of Judaism that unfortunately is one of our best kept secrets. We have in Toronto now a number of people, including my wife, who are teaching Jewish meditation practice, and we're finding that Jewish people are seeking this with tremendous thirst. There's no need to travel to India and get dysentery to learn meditation. You do it here in Toronto and the food is better. Roger Kamenetz, who wrote the book, the famous book, The Jew and the Lotus, had a meeting with the Dalai Lama and told him that when he grew up, to him, Judaism was never really meaningful because he saw Jewish practice as simply these commandments and things that you have to do. These commandments. And the Dalai Lama had to say to him, you know, Richard, perhaps you should see these commandments as opportunities for spiritual growth. It took the Dalai Lama to tell Roger Kamenetz, that the word mitzvah probably is better translated as a connector and not a commandment. And so my Kravitz often shares with his audiences, it's the church that translated Torah as law. We translated Torah as light. And if we begin to see our Judaism as a source of light, more so than a source of law, do this and don't do that. These are directions, but to bring us tremendous light and spiritual connection. I think it's inappropriate to point our finger at Jewish people who we see as jumping ship. The old saying goes that when you point your finger at someone, there are three fingers pointing right back at you. The Talmud says to us, Achbara lo ganva chura ganva. The Talmud says with a tremendous amount of wisdom, the mouse is not the thief. It's the hole in the wall over there that no one bothered to repair. That's really where you should point your finger. Don't blame the mouse. All of our Jewish brothers and sisters who are today in churches, in ashrams, in yoga groups, in meditation groups throughout the world, they didn't create that hole in the wall over there. They unfortunately fell through that hole. And if we want to understand the source of our problem, we really need as a community to focus inward, to take inventory. Years ago, we began thinking about our physical health. People started going for screening for colon cancer. We need to do what we call, in Jews for Judaism, a neshamaoscopy. Let's really look at our souls as a community. What kind of homes have we set up? What kind of synagogues have we set up? What kind of community structures and communities have we set up? Going beyond the question of being warm and friendly. That's a big part of it. But can we honestly say that we've created homes that are inspiring, that are passionate? Do we create synagogues where people come into our synagogues and not just are they friendly, but that they see Jewish people worshiping and praying with passion and joy and love for their Creator? Or is it just another boring service that they're sitting through? And when we do this kind of inventory, to me, it's not surprising, or maybe it is surprising, that we're not having more Jewish people elsewhere. I think we need to see these crises that we discussed here tonight as our wake-up call. And there's nothing greater for us as human beings, almost no greater blessing that God ever gave us than the ability to feel pain. The fact that we can be pained by something is a great blessing. If we got burned seriously and our bodies didn't register pain, you would not seek medical help. And the fact that this kind of a program tonight, to hear about all the Jewish people that are being lost to not our community, being lost to their own souls, to Christianity, to Eastern religions, to cults, to intermarriage, we really should feel tremendous pain. I'm sure most of you do. But that pain should move us to action. And I think it's important to understand that you cannot look to Jews for Judaism to solve this problem. You cannot look at your rabbis and your community leaders. Every single person in this room, every member of our community, needs to take ownership of this problem. This has to be our wake-up call. We can't simply solve this problem by thinking to ourselves, you know, we'll just give our children some more Jewish education. We'll sprinkle some more Jewish education on our children. That will solve the problem. That is tremendously wrong-headed. The problem here is not our children. I always tell my audiences that when you travel on an airplane, the cabin crew always tells you that if, God forbid, there's a problem, and we got to put those masks to come down as you can breathe oxygen, they always say, you better put the mask on yourself first, then put it on your children. If we think that we can simply sprinkle some Jewish education on our children, we're sadly mistaken. Judaism has to be caught. It cannot be taught. And our children need to come home to our homes to see us as adults who are in love with Judaism. And there was a reason why we chose this name for our organization. We didn't name it Jews Against Jesus. We didn't name this organization Jews Against Buddha. We named it Jews for Judaism because we believe very strongly that unless we as a community becomes a community that falls in love with Judaism and finds the passion to seek the spiritual path that Judaism is, and to experience it with joy and excitement and enthusiasm. If our children don't see that in our homes, everything they learn in school will probably just roll off their back. If people coming into our synagogues don't see us, we are the ones that are connected, you're here tonight, see us worshiping with joy and passion and spiritual fervor, why in the world would they come back? It's not difficult understanding why Jewish people have to schlep themselves maybe twice a year to a synagogue. It's a very difficult experience to go through. And whose fault is that? So we have a blessing here tonight. We have it in our hands. We have a problem that pains us. And if we take hold of this problem and take hold of our destinies, we can turn this tremendous challenge into an opportunity. We can see the golden lining, the silver lining behind this very, very cloudy problem, that we can all become Jews for Judaism to create a Jewish community and Jewish homes and Jewish synagogues that radiate joy and passion and spirituality. And I guarantee you, I can assure you, that if we create that kind of a Jewish world, we will not be faced with the problems that we were discussing here tonight. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Skobach. I don't know if some of you are aware, but collectively what you have here in this room is 150 years of experience in countering the missionary and cult threat. That experience is the combined number of years with the Jews for Judaism staff that is present here this evening. We probably have collectively the ability to help a lot of people. But that help cannot be availed of unless you do your part. I asked a few minutes ago, how many of you here know of somebody who's Jewish and believes in Jesus, and 10% of the hands went up. You should know that it is from people like you that we are able to access those people who so dearly need our help. If you know of somebody who is confused about their religious pursuits, they may be entertaining getting involved in a church, they may be possibly involved in one of these business cults that has recently invaded the Jewish community here in Toronto, they may be seeking Buddhism or Hinduism or Islam, or they may be contemplating an intermarriage. We want to help you. We're here to help you. There is no charge. You call, and we'll do the best we can.
Jews for Judaism hopes that you have found this audio recording to be helpful and informative. Jews for Judaism is an international organization dedicated to countering the multi-million dollar efforts of Christian missionary groups that target Jews, the impact of destructive cults and Eastern religions, and the growing rate of intermarriage that is devastating the Jewish community. Jews for Judaism achieves its goals through one-on-one counseling services and educational programs and materials that connect Jewish people to the spiritual depth, beauty, and wisdom of Judaism. Please contact Jews for Judaism if we can help you. www.jewsforjudaism.ca. Keeping Jews Jewish.
I want to just take a moment to tell you about Jews for Judaism if you're not already familiar with our organization. Jews for Judaism is North America's only full-time counter-missionary organization. We work to counter the efforts of missionaries that are targeting Jews for conversion, cults, and what have you. And the bulk of the work that we do is preventive education. That would be doing programs, lectures, classes, producing tapes, booklets, pamphlets, so that the Jewish community can be inoculated against the missionary and the cult threat. Another aspect of the work that we do is counseling. We spend a lot of time counseling Jews that are involved in various religious pursuits, and our hope is that through some investigative research, they might come to realize that the truth was always in their own backyard. But many people are not familiar with the other aspects of the work we do, and it's our intention that as a result of tonight's program, you'll have a greater appreciation for the various issues that threaten Jewish continuity, and as a result of touching base on some of these issues, you'll have a deeper clarity of the threat that faces our Jewish community, but also you'll have a deeper appreciation for the work that Jews for Judaism is doing to counter these problems. Tonight's speakers represent directors of various Jews for Judaism branches, and I'll just go through the speakers for tonight's program and the topics they'll be speaking on. The first speaker this evening will be Rabbi Ben Sion Kravitz. He'll be speaking on the problem of intermarriage and what can be done. Second topic is missionaries reporting from the front lines. That will be Mark Powers. Mark Powers is the executive director of the Baltimore branch. I failed to mention that Rabbi Ben Sion Kravitz is the founding director of Jews for Judaism International, based in Los Angeles. Our third speaker this evening will be Scott Hillman. He'll be speaking on cults. Are they still a concern? He's based in Washington and also works out of our Baltimore branch. And lastly, spiritual hunger, the lure of Eastern religions. This talk will be given by Rabbi Michael Skobach, who is the educational director and senior counselor for the Toronto branch of Jews for Judaism. I also want to just take a moment to welcome the other members of the Jews for Judaism staff that are visiting us here today. We have Rabbi Perry from Los Angeles. We have Rabbi Graham Finkelstein from Johannesburg, South Africa. We have Shoshana Zakhar, who is from Baltimore, our webmaster, the one who's responsible for our very popular website. Thank you. Jerry Siegel, who is our director from New York City and also the author of the book, The Jew and the Christian Missionary, probably the most exhaustive book written on the topic in our current day, dealing with the threat of missionaries. We have also in the audience today somebody who we as a Toronto Jewish community, two people who we as a Jewish community should be very appreciative of for the work they have done for Jews for Judaism in both their support as dedicated volunteers now for they're in their eighth year. They are personally responsible today for raising 10% of the budget of Jews for Judaism. That's Jerry and Sandy Genesov. Jerry and Sandy, we really appreciate your help. We have in the audience here today also a very esteemed colleague from Florida who is the executive director of a similar organization as Jews for Judaism. The organization in Florida is Torah Life and Living. And the executive director, Aaron Schwartzbaum, if you could just stand up and be recognized, Aaron, who's very, very dedicated to this work. Thank you for being here tonight, Aaron. Aaron is actually one of these individuals that knows me from the beginnings when we were trying to get Jews for Judaism off the ground, and he was constantly encouraging us to do the effort, and I hope he's hopping a little nachas tonight to see that we've got ourselves a considerable presence here, not only in Toronto, but in Canada. Anyways, enough with the commercials and the slapping on the back. I hope I didn't leave anybody out. No. Okay, so I would like to introduce our first speaker, as I mentioned, Rabbi Ben Sion Kravitz, He founded Jews for Judaism International in 1985 in Los Angeles, fighting the missionary threat in Southern California. He is a renowned counter-missionary expert. He is the author of the book that you have been able to access for free this evening, The Jewish Response to Missionaries, Counter-Missionary Handbook. And if you have not received one, please make sure you get one before you leave. It is now probably one of the most popular Jewish books in Jewish publishing history, over 150,000 in print. I'd like to introduce Rabbi Ben-Zion Kravitz.
Thank you very much for that very generous introduction. Julius pointed out to me that I should try to keep my presentation to 20 minutes, something that I'm not used to doing. So I told him I would do it if I could sing a song and at least complete the song, and he said, fine. So here goes. A billion bottles of beer on the wall. A billion bottles of beer. So I must tell you, I'm very pleased to be here. I'm very happy that you are able to see the vast array of resources that Jews for Judaism as an international organization has grown. Together, I think we could easily say that we have made a major impact worldwide on the missionary and cult problem. Speaking just about Los Angeles, I know for an absolute fact that our organization in Los Angeles is already responsible for bringing back from Christianity Jews who were already involved, over 250 Jewish people who were involved in Christianity over the years that we've been doing it. And I know that when you combine the other offices, you'll just start to get a picture of how many people we have actually helped and changed their lives. This evening I've been asked to speak about one of the most painful issues that confronts the Jewish community. That is an issue that really stymies the mind of how to solve it. That's the issue of intermarriage. Intermarriage has grown, the statistics tell us, from somewhere around 6% of the Jewish population after World War II to presently somewhere up to 52%. It is a problem that has gotten so bad that many families have given up hope of figuring out how to prevent it or undo an intermarriage. They've just decided we must go with the flow. I don't believe that that has to be our only response, especially in the fact that evangelical Christian missionaries are using the intermarriage issue as another ingenious way to assimilate Jews into Christianity. Several years ago in Newsweek magazine, when they explored the issue of intermarriage, the writer of the article wrote the following statement, that a young little boy was attending a synagogue preschool. And one day the teacher asked him, "Who do you love?" And this boy, a product of an intermarriage, responded, "I love Jesus." So for those that think that an intermarriage will simply allow people to go in their own paths and that the influences of Christianity will not affect them, that story powerfully points out that that's not the case. Realizing that for many intermarried couples, the issue of faith and belief is something that is probably not on their mind when they get married. It's distant from their thoughts. And those of us in the room that have experienced that issue in our families or friends know that that's a fact. At some point in that relationship, the issue of faith and religion may come to the front of the issues in their marriage. I know a personal case in Los Angeles where a Jewish man who married a non-Jewish woman. He himself was so assimilated that the thought of even suggesting a conversion on her part didn't even enter his mind to suggest it. There was absolutely no interest in faith or religion in his relationship. 10 years into the marriage, very happy couple in terms of non-religious issues. The wife's mother became ill. And while visiting her in the hospital, her memories of her childhood faith became aroused. And over a period of a year, she rediscovered her connection to God and to faith. And I think many of us would say that that's a very positive and good thing for this non-Jewish individual. She prayed with her mother. It gave her strength. When she presented this to her husband, he shrugged his shoulders and said, "Well, it's not for me. I'm not interested." Wanting something cohesive in their marriage, she sought help. She turned to a missionary group called Chosen People Ministries, who had recently published a newsletter with the cover saying, "Intermarriage, a new witnessing frontier." And in the accompanying article to that magazine, just one sentence from it makes a very powerful statement. "We in Chosen People Ministries are glad to provide a spiritual home for intermarried couples and their children, where they can be affirmed and encouraged in their Jewish identities and at the same time of faith in Yeshua," quote, "Jesus the Messiah." Their answer to the spiritual dilemma in an interfaith marriage is to give the couple both. They can be Jewish and Christian simultaneously, the same presentation that's been given by Jews for Jesus and missionaries to you and to your neighbors and to your friends and children. But now it's specifically being targeted at intermarried couples. What is the solution to intermarriage and to this particular problem? Of all the research that has been done, the only suggestion that has proven to be successful is to make the Jewish partner understand what it means to be Jewish. Answering the question of why be Jewish. Because if the person doesn't feel why they should be Jewish, and understand being Jewish, and feel a spiritual uplifting within their soul for being Jewish, then to tell them not to marry someone who's not Jewish, it means absolutely nothing to them. Recognizing this specific problem with intermarried couples being targeted by missionaries, the Jewish Community Foundation in Los Angeles funded Jews for Judaism with a grant of $35,000 to create a program that would reach out to interfaith couples who have already been married for years. It's already an accepted fact in their lives. And try to reach to them and inoculate them against this missionary argument, and also show them that there is a community that cares for them, that will offer warmth to them. So working with interfaith experts throughout California, we came up with a webpage and a program of lectures, which is our response to intermarriage and interfaith couples. We call the program Two Roads, One Path. And for anyone who wants to see the webpage, they can go to tworoadsonepath.com. It is something different than you've ever experienced before, because it doesn't attack them. It doesn't condemn them. Because if you want to bring them closer, you must bring people closer with warmth. This campaign will be launched in full within the next month, and hopefully will spread to our other centers throughout the world. But to tell you how, in a nutshell, that warmth and caring can help a person, I'll end with a short story. Last November, a Jewish family was referred to our office in Los Angeles by their conservative rabbi. They came to the office and met with me and told me of their dilemma. Their dilemma was that their son, Jonathan, a brilliant student at the University of California in San Diego, a junior, was dating a non-Jewish girl who was a Christian, and according to them, had now started to explore Christianity himself. they were beyond words, the pain that they expressed to me. And they came seeking help. Their rabbi had referred them to Jews for Judaism as the resource that he knew of that could help them. And we figured out a way to make Jonathan feel comfortable coming to meet with me. It was interesting that they told me that one of his favorite pastimes was scuba diving, which happens to be one of mine. So when he finally called up and said, "My parents want me to talk to you," I said, "Oh, about scuba diving?" And he just said, "Scuba diving? How are you certified?" And he listed them off. We had a nice talk about that. And the barriers between us broke down, and we really hit it off very well. He agreed that during winter break he would come to my home and meet with me. He showed up the last week of December to my home and spent 6 hours straight talking to me. We spoke about passages in the Bible that he had been studying, whether in Isaiah, in Daniel. We spoke about the importance of analyzing every nuance of our Bible and how important it is. And then he asked me if I had a personal relationship with God. Did I really feel that God was touching my life? So I told them the story of how when my wife, 22 years ago, was expecting our first child, she went into labor 10 and a half weeks premature. We rushed her to the hospital, and the doctors tried everything to stop the labor, but they couldn't. They came to me 15 hours after we were in the hospital, and they said, "Rabbi Kravitz, there's no way this child can survive. The baby is breached, the umbilical cord is around its neck, the lungs are not developed. We're just going to do a cesarean section to save your wife's life now." So my wife and I sat and we prayed to God for help. And as they took my wife into the operating room, I told her the story of the great Rav, Rabbi Schneur Zalman of Liadi, who on Yom Kippur ran from the synagogue to seek out a woman who was giving birth but didn't have any food or any heat in her home. And he found her and he made a fire and he cooked food and he helped deliver the baby and he saved that baby's life. And I said, in the merit of that great rabbi, Rabbi Schneur Zalman, perhaps God will also help us. 2 hours later, as they rolled this small child about this big out to the emergency room with tubes in his arm and in nose, we were in shock. The doctor came back into the office, into the waiting room, and said, "Rabbi Kravitz, I have to talk to you. I saw his name was Dr. Tenenbaum, and I felt good because he's Jewish." He said, "We don't understand. It's a miracle. Everybody in the emergency room is calling this the miracle baby. We can't explain how it's happening." My first question to the doctor was, "Doctor, what is your Hebrew name?" And I looked at him, and he answered back, "My Hebrew name is Schneur Zalman." The exact same name as the rabbi in the story. And I told that story to Jonathan, and he came back the following week for 6 hours. And he was so moved, he went back to San Diego a different person. 3 months passed, and I didn't hear from him. 2 weeks before Passover, I sent him an email. "Jonathan, I miss having contact with you. Maybe you'll come for the Seder." He sends back an email the next day, "Of course I'll come, and I have to tell you what happened. Rabbi Kravitz, 2 weeks ago I was in church. And I was on my knees in the church praying. And I was so confused by the issues that I heard from the Christians and from you. I didn't know what to do. I said, God, send me a sign." I got up from my knees, sat down in the pew, and I hear two women speaking behind me. And one turns to the other and says, "I have to tell you about the wonderful Shabbat experience I had at my Jewish neighbor's house." He said, "Rabbi, I was blown away." I said, "You're coming for Pesach?" He said, "Definitely, after that." 2 weeks go by, I call him on the cell phone. You're still coming?" He says, "Rabbi, I'm definitely coming." I said, "That was an amazing story you told me." He said, "That's not the end." I said, "What's the end of the story?" He says, "Rabbi, I wasn't sure if that was really a sign. And I remembered the story you told me about your son, Schneur Zalman." So I said, "God, send me a more specific sign. Let me meet someone with the same Hebrew name as myself." He said, "Rabbi, last night I was in an AOL chat room. Someone sent me an instant message and I started speaking with him. He turns out to be Jewish. I type, 'What is your Hebrew name?' He types back, 'Yosef Pesa.' He said, 'Rabbi, that's my name.' He said, 'That's enough. God answered my prayers, I'm back. He not only broke off his relationship with the non-Jewish girl, he not only gave up his exploration of Christianity, which in fact he had already converted, he is now learning biblical Hebrew and planning this December to go on the birthright experience to Eretz Yisrael and to be totally immersed in Judaism. This is the message we can give our people. The message of spirituality, of warmth and caring. And with that, individually, one by one, we will help rescue many, many thousands of people. And this is the work that we're doing, and I appreciate your support and help. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Kravitz. I just want everybody to appreciate that it really is a limited amount of time that we have for each of our speakers tonight to elaborate on these issues. So don't be too concerned. There'll be plenty of time afterwards for questions and answers. And the leading dignitaries are very happy to stay till as late as is necessary to answer your questions. Our second speaker for the evening is Mark Powers. He is the executive director of the Baltimore branch as well as the national director of Jews for Judaism. He's got many years of experience dealing with the problem of missionaries and cults facing our Jewish community. And I'm going to ask Mark to come and speak on missionaries reporting from the front lines and what Jews for Judaism is doing about it.
Thank you, Julius. Like Rabbi Kravitz, I too have a problem with speaking for only 20 minutes. But I'm not going to sing, thank God. But I have an even bigger problem, and that is standing in one spot. Because I'm the proverbial wandering Jew. I hate podiums. I hate microphones. I'd much rather be out there with you, which is the way I normally conduct my programs. However, for the sake of the video cameras this evening, I'm stationary. So if I look like I'm having a problem, that's why. After that inspiring story by Rabbi Kravitz, I get to be the wet blanket. It has fallen to me to discuss the growth of the missionary problem around the world, reporting from the front lines. And I guess the reason that they gave me this particular topic is because of my activities worldwide. I'm not only in the United States, occasionally in Canada, but also in many, many countries around the world. When we look at the missionary problem, this problem, as we know it today, is really about 50-some-odd years old in its present form. That is, taking Christianity, dressing it up to look Jewish, and presenting it to the Jewish community. Now, I don't think I would surprise anybody here if I told you that Christians have always wanted Jews to become Christian. Come in. I suspect it's a sign of... Let me think on that. So, while Christians have always wanted Jews to become Christian, the method that they're using today, groups like Jews for Jesus, taking Christianity, dressing it up to look Jewish, calling their pastors, rabbis, their congregations, synagogues, wrapping themselves in talasim, singing Hebrew songs, and telling the Jewish community that it's the most Jewish thing in the world to believe in Yeshua or Jesus. That methodology is only about 50 years old. But that methodology has worked perhaps far beyond their wildest dreams. We frequently hear that they've converted more Jews in the past 19 years than they have in the past 19 centuries. It's not clear as to who originally came up with that quote, us or them, but they love to quote it, and I don't have any problem quoting it back, because it's probably very, very true. But this missionary movement, which started primarily in North America, and primarily in the United States, has now been exported all over the world.
In 1978, there were approximately 20 Hebrew Christian congregations in North America. Today, as we look around, there are over 400 Hebrew Christian congregations in North America alone. There are over 100 of these congregations in Eretz Yisrael. They produced a book in 1999, Facts and Myths about the Messianic Congregations in Israel. And this book lists congregation after congregation. And we know that there are even more there now. That is, by the way, combined, if you combine the number of conservative and reform congregations in Israel, that far exceeds the number there. And then we turn to the former Soviet Union. The former Soviet Union has become a magnet for the missionaries. When the gates opened up, the missionaries flooded in. We have been using a figure of somewhere around 38 to 50 Hebrew Christian congregations in the FSU. But unfortunately, that number is wrong, dead wrong. I came back from Moscow in May, where I had the opportunity to present a program on the missionaries to leaders of 40 different Jewish communities around the FSU, and we did a survey. There are over 100 congregations in the Ukraine alone. We estimate that there may be another 75 to 150 congregations in the rest of the FSU. The number is outstanding, unbelievable, and they are growing by leaps and bounds. Christian missionaries are literally tripping over themselves to get to Russian Jews. And while they are increasing the numbers of the congregations in the FSU, they are not ignoring Russian Jews wherever they may be, whether it's here in Toronto, in the United States, and particularly in Eretz Yisrael. They're using whatever method they can possibly devise to reach out and ensnare the Russian Jews in their programs. And they're succeeding. In fact, the largest number of the Hebrew Christian congregations in Eretz Yisrael are made up of former Russian Jews. But this is a worldwide problem, and it's a problem that, as I indicated, has been exported from primarily the United States. The United States gave all sorts of wonderful things to the world. This is not one of them. We've noticed an increase in South America, which seems to be the next target for the missionary groups. And in fact, we are tracking over 900 U.S.-based and North American-based missionary groups that have as their agenda the same agenda as Jews for Jesus. And when you look at the response of the Jewish community, it pales in comparison. These groups are spending big dollars as well. Last year, Jews for Jesus had a budget of somewhere between $12 and $13 million. That's American. You're going to have to help me with Canadian. I'm sorry. But Jews for Jesus is one group out of over 900 that we're aware of. Chosen People Ministries, over $7 million. Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry, $5 million. And by the time we finish adding up all of the money that these groups are spending in their efforts to convert Jews, we estimate that each year they're putting forth $270 million in that effort. And figure it out. What's the price of a Jew? In 1978, we estimated that there were maybe 10,000 Jews involved in this movement. Today, that number is over 250,000. So they're succeeding. And when we look at that, and when we look at the response of the Jewish community, whether it's from Jews for Judaism or Torah Life and Living, and believe me, Aaron knows that there are few groups out there that are working to try and combat the efforts of these groups. It seems almost insurmountable. It seems extremely frustrating. And if I can, I'd like to tell you a short story. It seems that there was this little boy who lived by the sea, and he heard that the following day there was going to be an extremely low tide. And he knew that when the tide goes out, that the starfish becomes stranded on the beach. And this little boy loved starfish. And he wanted to do something for these starfish. So he got up real early the next morning. He goes down to the beach. And as he starts to walk along, he sees a starfish. He picks it up and he throws it into the water. And he walks a little bit further. He sees another starfish. He picks it up and he throws it into the water. And there's a man watching this little boy as he's walking down the beach, picking up starfish and throwing them into the water. And the man walks over to him and he says, "What are you doing?" And the little boy explains about the low tide. And the man says, "I can't believe you're doing that. I mean, just look down the beach in this direction. Look at all the starfish. And then turn around and look at all the starfish down the beach in this direction. You can't possibly, even if you work all day, you can't possibly make a difference." Little boy thinks about it. Scratches his head. And he reaches down and picks up a starfish and throws it into the water. And he turns to the man and he says, "I made a difference to that one." And so Jews for Judaism, in spite of what seems like overwhelming odds, we continue to make a difference as we reach out to the people who are ensnared by these missionary groups. But even before they become ensnared, the programs that Jews for Judaism has developed, the educational preventive programs that we have taken around the country and around the world, will be meeting, for example, in August with leaders of Hillel, over 200 leaders of Hillel from across the former Soviet Union. Rabbi Kravitz, Rabbi Skobach, myself have been throughout South Africa. Rabbi Skobach and Rabbi Kravitz have been to Australia. And we've been numerous times to Eretz Yisrael to do preventive programming to let the Jewish community know that there is a problem out there. Many people don't believe that this is a problem until it hits them. Well, I can assure you that with the growth rate in this movement, very, very shortly, there is going to be very few families out there who will not be touched by this problem. And we want to see if there's something that we can do to prevent it, to prevent more heartache for families in the Jewish community. We've introduced some rather innovative programs. In the Baltimore office, we developed a program called CPR for the Jewish soul, Community Prevention and Response, in which we enter into a Jewish community for a week to 2 weeks, and we do extensive programming throughout the entire community, not just one lecture, and not in just one place, but in every segment of the Jewish community, so that this message, that there is a Jewish response, that there is a good reason why for the past 2,000 years Jews have said no to Jesus, that information gets to every segment of the Jewish community. And the program has been very, very well received across the United States and even in South Africa. We'll be introducing this fall a program that we call JTTV, modeled after MTV. It's our outreach to Jewish youth on a, I guess, kind of a hip way of reaching the youth, something that hopefully they can connect with. And through cyberspace and our extensive website and the new website at JTTV, we connect with Jewish town meetings, some of them held in conjunction with the CPR program, that kids in their teens, prior to their reaching college, can relate to, with information that they can relate to, something that is speaking to them, something that hopefully will be useful to them and hopefully will keep them connected to the Jewish community. And of course, Jews for Judaism has been at the forefront of providing material in Russian around the world to combat the missionaries. The booklet that you picked up outside, Jewish Responses to the Missionaries, is also available in Russian. We also have Michael Skobak's take and the only video on this subject in the Russian language, and that information has been made available worldwide. There's a cute little story about the first time that Rabbi Skobak went to Russia. And this was after his tape had received rather wide distribution there. And he was doing a program for some people in Moscow, and when he was introduced, several people got up and complained and screamed rather loudly, "That's not Rabbi Skobak!" And of course we were a little confused because we've known Michael for many years. But it seems that this particular tape had made its way to some of the far reaches of the former Soviet Union, and the person that we had record the tape, the translation of it, was female. And so they were expecting a female Rabbi Skobak. Fortunately, we were able to convince them that this was the real item, and his reputation has spread since then, in spite of the fact that the tape is recorded by somebody who's female. In addition to the efforts that Jews for Judaism is making, there are efforts that you as a community can make, because, quite honestly, we can't do this alone. We need your help. As you can see from the people that Julius introduced, there are a few of us. And clearly, not enough to go around. In spite of the fact that we have offices across the U.S., Canada, South Africa, and a task force in Australia, when we look at just one of those groups, remember Jews for Jesus? I'm sure you've heard of them. Jews for Jesus has a full-time staff of over 150 people. And that's just one group. So we need your help. In fact, all of you need to be Jews for Judaism. All of you need to get the message out that there are organizations out there that can help in response to the Jewish communities. But even more than that, repeatedly when we ask people how they got involved or why they got involved, one of the answers that ranks fairly high up there is because they made an effort to connect to the Jewish community, but they found the Jewish community too cold, too distant, unfriendly, not welcoming. And I know that it's not happening in your synagogue or your neighborhood, but I can tell you that unfortunately this is a reputation that the Jewish community around the world has. And it's something that we, each one of us, can do something about. I had the opportunity to take my son to a small private college in New England when we were looking for a school for him, and we stepped into a synagogue for Monday davening, and the place was jam-packed. There must have been 12, maybe 13 people there. And at the end of davening, before we had even put away our tefillin, the place emptied out, and not one person, not one single person, said one word to either one of us. And I can tell you it's been a tremendous experience here in Toronto the last 2 days, because in the two synagogues that we were in, just about everybody came over to ask us who we were, what we were doing, and to welcome us. But we need to extend that effort throughout the entire Jewish community to make the Jewish community a warm, welcoming, friendly place, a place where Jews want to be, a place where Jews feel welcome and at home. Because I can guarantee you that if we don't do it, the missionaries will. It's just something very small, but it's a start. It's something that each and every one of you can do to help in this effort to get the word out that the Jewish community is a place for Jews and that Jews for Judaism is a place that you can go for Jewish answers to the information, the misinformation that the missionaries are spreading. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Mark. You know, Mr. Powers alluded to a very, very serious problem. I just want to throw a question out to the audience to drive the point home. A lot of times when we do these presentations to Jewish audiences, there's a lot of skepticism. There's a big question mark over people's heads. And the question is it really such a problem? Are you really, really giving us the right figures? So I thought I'd try a quick experiment in this very short break here and ask you to verify for us how big a problem this is. I'm going to ask for a show of hands. And I predict at least 10 hands will go up. We have about 100 people here. 10 hands are going to go up, I feel. This isn't prophecy. This is statistics. How many of you here today know of somebody who is Jewish and believes in Jesus? Hands up. Just want to see the hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay. 12. There we go. The reason I did this is statistically we have found in Canada every time we ask that question, regardless of the size of the audience, 10% of all Jewish audiences know of somebody who's Jewish and believes in Jesus. To show you how frightening the problem is, we're in Canada. We're a generation behind the U.S. When we ask this question in America, 25% of the hands go up. We have a problem. But the problem goes beyond missionaries. Our next speaker, Scott Hillman, works in conjunction with the Jews for Judaism office in Washington and in Baltimore. He's going to speak on cults. Are they still a concern? Scott?
Well, following our international director and our founding director is always a wonderful place to be. And just as Mark says, tying me down to a lectern is a very hard thing. I'm the one they get to jump around and do the teamwork and really get out there and work the crowd. So you'll have to excuse me if I'm not exactly centered for the cameras and for the video. The question in front of us is cults. Are they still a concern? I can do it very quickly, save us a lot of time. Yes. End of statement, because you have to understand something. You're all here tonight. And I expect that when you got up this morning, you spent the day talking with people, listening to things on the radio or the television, maybe reading newspaper. Maybe you kind of shared an interest with someone, whether it be politics, or maybe you had an idea for a new business, or maybe you tried to figure out how you're going to take care of your health, or get prosperous, or maybe find something special to do with your life. Maybe you wanted to really get into your spirituality. You were set up to find meaning. In every one of those cases, that makes you a perfect target. You're all set to join a cult. Because you have to understand something. Joining a cult... yes. Joining a cult isn't what actually occurs. You're recruited. And the way you're recruited... very simple. You have a relationship with someone, and you have a desire to do something with your life. That's all it takes for you to be recruited. So anyone you know who says, oh, I'm never going to be recruited into a cult, not me, I know too much. I already got it all figured out. They're actually the best recruits, and they're the ones who fall for it first. Now, I want to get quite specific here, because whenever people read about cults or hear about cults, it's always a scare word. A lot of people like to say, that group over there is a cult, not my group. I'm not involved with that. I could never become involved with that. Sorry, it doesn't work that way. When Jews for Judaism goes out and talks about cults, we're talking about something very specific. Because really, if you look at the definitions of cults, you're talking about something that has been abused. The press constantly likes to refer to any group that's a little different as a cult. When people are trying to set their enemies up, they always say, oh, that's a cultic group. That's why we're very careful when we talk about groups. There is a very specific understanding. I mean, if you were to open up Webster's Dictionary, look up the word cult, you can have 5 or 6 definitions. And you know what? Most of them involve very basic things. You would be able to say that the Boy Scouts or the Girl Scouts are a cult. You have that in Canada, right? Something like that. The Scouts are a cult. Sorry. You could say that the Marines or your Army is a cult. Because they would fit certain definitions. In Webster's, it says, a religion that is considered or regarded as unorthodox or spurious. Okay. Or a system for the cure of a disease based on dogmas or tenets or principles set forth by someone who is ready to put it forth to the exclusion of any scientific evidence. That's a cult. Or showing a greater obsessive devotion or dedication to some person, idea, or thing. Well, how many people do we know that don't get enamored of some idea or person or thing? Ah, that's a cult. We go a little step further. And the reason I do this, and I do this with all the audiences, so you understand what we're talking about. When we use the word cult, we're talking about something that's destructive. And I want you to also know that when you talk about a cult, you aren't just talking about that one individual who gets involved. You're talking about the family, the friends, and the general community as well. Because a cult doesn't just pick off one person when it does recruitment. So when we talk about cults, we talk about the totalist type. Very specific words. Actually, the definition that we use is taken from the American Psychiatric Association. They did a task force. Because you're talking about deceptive and indirect techniques of persuasion and control. That's the key here. Any group that isn't forthcoming with you, anytime you ask a question, there's a problem. Red flags should shoot up immediately. If you ask a question, they say, oh, don't worry, that's not important right now. We'll get to that later. And they don't get to it when you think later is, and you can't convince them that you really want an answer. You've got a red flag. You really have to pay attention. But if that group or movement exhibits a great devotion or excessive obsession to that person, idea, or thing, and this is the key, it employs unethically manipulative, and that means the deceptive and indirect, that's the key, techniques of persuasion and control, then we have a problem here. But you know what? People don't realize this until they see it in the news. Cults aren't a problem. Unless, of course, they just killed 900 people down in South America, then it's a problem. Or people take their lives, Heaven's Gate, or someone blows up something, or releases nerve gas on a subway, then it's cults a problem. It's not the way it works anymore. The experts in the field talk about the fact that in North America alone, there are probably about 5,000 economic, political, and religious cults operating. And they have approximately 2.5 million people as members, but it's affecting about 20 million people. This is just North America. The cult problem is so prevalent that the chances of a family member joining a cult are greater than that of a family member catching chicken pox. I'd like to put it in that term because, you know, statistics are a pain in the neck. You all have family and friends. You know about catching chicken pox. It's more likely you're going to lose someone to a cult than you are them catching chicken pox. And that was, Dr. Paul Martin said this a short while ago. He runs a rehabilitation center for ex-cult members. He knows what he's talking about. The problem is that all of these dangers are growing. The fact that we don't see it is because when we all got worried about it back in the 70s, it was a big thing because we saw it on the streets. We saw it on the college campuses. We were concerned that our youth were getting caught up in it. But it's changed. The cults have changed. They've gone corporate. Anybody out here a single practitioner? Whether it be a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer? You probably get solicited for management companies. I can help your business. We can help your business. Come to this seminar. Come to that seminar. A lot of those are front groups. Or you decided, you know what? I want to really get into my own business. I want to set something up for me. Yeah, I'm thinking multi-level marketing might be my cup of tea. I'm going to get into some sales. A lot of those groups are cult fronts. Or maybe, you know what? I'm having some problems in my relationships. I think I'm going to join some sort of a psychotherapy group, a group awareness therapy. I'm going to go out and I'm going to really get into things and try to understand my feelings and what it means to be me and how I should relate to other people. Some of those groups are very helpful. Others are going to suck you right in. Or maybe you've decided, hey, you know what? Spirituality I'm dealing with now, Shul's kind of nice, but I'm not really getting much out of it. I think I want to go into some mysticism. I think I want to really get into some ancient texts and really deal with what it means. And I want some prosperity brought into my life. I want to get healthy. And that I have this promise. I understand from all this wonderful stuff I'm reading that all I have to do is get into ancient texts and I'm going to be okay. Or maybe you've decided, you know what? That moon out there comes and goes and there's some sort of a cycle working here. And there's a group that kind of meets out in the woods and looks at the moon. Maybe I'm going to go sit out there and meditate a bit. Some of these groups are very legitimate. Many of them are not. But the thing is, people are getting caught up in this every single day. And as I said in the first place, why do we call it a cult? And what's the effect it's having on us and the Jewish community? And what can we do about it? Very simple. We call it a cult because they are not direct when you ask the question. Many of these groups require you to sign up for their seminars before you can get any information about what's going to go on at the seminar. When you show up, you'll know what's going on. But you have to pre-register and give them a lot of information first, along with, of course, your major cash contribution. Others say, you know, come take this series of courses at X number of dollars, and we promise you by the end of it, you will find prosperity. But they don't tell you what the steps are going to be, what the program's going to be, what the qualifications of the people are. What we're saying is, be a good spiritual consumer. Get out there and know what you're buying. Because when you don't, you run into troubles. And we're talking all across the board. In the last 4 or 5 months alone, number of cult cases that come through my office are tremendous. And the way they affect the family is even worse. A family had a child who was having difficulties, got them to a proper psychiatrist, trying to deal with a drug problem and some psychological problems went along with it. The psychiatrist felt they needed a resident treatment program. And you know what? Opened up the file, looked through a couple of things that had been sent to her, and said, this is the one. It's a good program. It's got all these wonderful awards given to it, et cetera, et cetera. We think that that's where your son should go. They pulled a few strings. They got him in. No problem. After the fact, we get a call. This is within the first couple of days that the boy's there. Why? Because this happened to have been an observant child, and they wouldn't give him kosher or vegetarian food, at least, at the place. He was getting a hassle, so he called home. He found a way to get to a phone, which was interesting, but I'm not going to go into that. And he made the call and said, something's wrong here. So the psychiatrist had enough sense to call us. We recognized, unfortunately, the group immediately, the place that had been sent. And it was a front for a cult. A very large cult, and I'll leave it at that. But the point is that the psychiatrist didn't know. She had been solicited, just as psychiatrists all across the country, all across North America, are solicited because this is one of the larger residential treatment programs. They have some success. But the bigger success that they have is moving the people right into the cult. The statistics are very, very somber. And the way that people get involved are very straightforward. They're searching for meaning. They're looking for something special to do with their life. Or they're looking to get rich quick. Or they're looking to improve the business they have or the practice they have. In each of those cases, people get sucked in because they shut down their critical thinking skills. One of the most important things that we have is a brain. And the minute we say, you know what, this looks good, I'm just going to buy it. How many of you watch infomercials just for the fun of it? How many of you bought something from an infomercial? Okay. You don't want to admit it. This is all marketing. We've talked about intermarriage. We've talked about missionaries. They also, and the missionaries capitalize on many of the techniques. The missionary groups, though, can be cultic. They are not cults, per se. Some of them do develop into cults, individual groupings. But there is a difference between the missionaries and the cults that we deal with. And Jews for Judaism has been dealing with it. We are on the front lines in the Jewish community and also the non-Jewish community. We work interfaith on the cult problem because it's a societal problem, and it's a big one. We've developed certain programs in Canada. You have Cultivating. It's a worldwide program. Rabbi Spobach runs that specifically for training seminars because education is one of our key things. And as I said before, critical thinking, which as Jews we know, we've never been asked to check our brains at the door. Asking questions is part and parcel of what we are. We are so chutzpahdik, we argue with God. So we shouldn't ask a few questions of the group that we're joining? Come on. The key here is getting the education and realizing when you're in the situation. And if you feel that your questions aren't being answered in the situation, doing something about it. I go around to colleges and do a program called Cults 101, where we go through not only the definition, but the history. And then we go through the techniques and what are the actual characteristics, such as that charismatic leadership and mind control techniques. And those things that occur within a group, the us versus them, right? We're okay, they're the ones who aren't, that occur within these closed groups. It's something that's very important because people have stopped thinking. You know, Charlie Chan used to say, a parachute is like a mind, right? It only works when it's open. But a philosopher in the last century said, an open mind is wonderful, but you can't afford to allow your brains to fall out. Both the cults and the missionaries capitalize on this. The fact that we don't necessarily ask questions, the fact that we have certain responses that we do automatically, especially to someone in authority. And authority just is the authority that we grant them. Whether it be someone who comes to speak, and you know, you have that question, and you heard the lecture, and they went into a Q&A, and you just never asked a question of them. That happens in many situations. You just said that people don't like to admit it when they've made a mistake. Yeah, but once we're honest with ourselves, then we can feel comfortable in asking the questions of somebody else. Jews for Judaism is part of both its CPR program and JTTV, and as part of its curricular programs that go forth for teachers. Educating the educators is very important, because as you see, there are just a few of us. But once we can educate the educators, they can educate the communities. And that's very important. So that's how we spend our time in proactive education. And then, of course, the counseling. The counseling to individuals and the support for families and communities in many cases. Because these groups don't just come in and take up residence and go after just that one family down the block. Once they get that one family is set to start up with everyone else in the neighborhood. So, as Mark said earlier, you're the eyes and ears out there. If you see a group that's starting to act in a specific way, or if members of your community are starting to go into a certain path that, you know what, there are some questions on, and they don't quite have the answers, or they don't quite understand what the group's about, or, you know, the group has some questionable practices, get out there and ask the questions. Call us up. We'll be happy to help you ask the questions. But the thing is to ask them and to get answers. Because that's how you respond to a cult that's in your midst. through information and exposure, through dealing with it in a straightforward fashion, not by saying, you know what, it's a free country. If that's what they want to hold by, let them hold by it. Because if they're straightforward about it, absolutely. Everyone's entitled to their opinion. Everyone's entitled to their way of life. But when it's done through deception, it's not fair to anybody. It's not fair to the individual, the family, or the community. And that's why we're here to help, and we welcome your help in dealing with it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Scott. You know, he closed off by saying, we're here to help. When you need help and it's an emergency, what do you dial? 911. Jews for Judaism has been called the 911 for Jewish survival. We get calls so many times for people who are unfortunately involved in cults, Jews involved in missionaries. We have people calling us up with intermarriage problems. But they call us because there are so few agencies in the Jewish community that have the expertise to deal with these problems. One such expert who has close to 30 years' experience in the field is Rabbi Michael Skobach. Not only has he worked with dealing with the problem of missionaries as they confront the Jewish community, not only has he worked intensively in understanding deceptive mind control by cult groups, he also has worked very deeply in understanding what it is that fills the spiritual hunger of the Jew. The next talk by Rabbi Michael Skobach, the Education Director for Jews for Judaism and our senior counselor, is entitled Spiritual Hunger, the Lure of Eastern Religions.
I have no problem with podiums. I'm a tree hugger. I'm going to grab onto this thing for dear life. I think after focusing so much of our efforts for years with the concern that we had for Jewish people being lost to churches, we began to realize that that wasn't the only place Jews were ending up. When I first came to Toronto about 10 years ago, I was working as the Jewish chaplain at the University of Toronto. And one of my colleagues, the Hindu chaplain, invited me to speak at his temple on a Sunday morning downtown in Toronto. And I decided I would go because I thought maybe I would meet one or two Jewish people there. I showed up at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I must tell you, I've been in this line of work for a long time. I'm rarely shocked. But this Hindu temple in downtown Toronto was crawling with Jews. I was completely stunned. And since that point, I've been trying to understand the dimensions of this phenomenon and to understand really what lies at the heart of it. Some of you might know that today, as we speak here, about one half of all the Israelis who finish their army service will go for extended trips to the Far East, India, Nepal, Thailand, for up to a year, and many of them to explore the spiritual treasures of the East, sampling of the ashrams, the gurus, the yoga practice. When my wife and I went to India several years ago to run Passover Seders, we were completely taken aback by the fact that almost all the signs on the street in the neighborhood we were staying in New Delhi were written in Hebrew. The amount of Hebrew we heard spoken in the street made us pinch ourselves to wonder if maybe we weren't in Tel Aviv. And today, if you want to attend the largest Seder in the world, it takes place not in Israel or in New York, but in Kathmandu, Nepal, where every year over 1,300 Jewish people are there, not at their Jewish homes, but celebrating Passover. A number of years ago, I met a woman in Chicago who was a convert to Judaism named Diane. And she was explaining to me her genesis, her story, how she ended up as a Jew. She came from very, very far away, from a Midwestern family, not a Jew in her area. And she told me she became a spiritual seeker. And she traveled all over the world to different ashrams, different spiritual centers, learning meditation and yoga and going to different gurus. And she told me the one thing that was constant no matter where she went was that sometimes half the people at these retreats were Jewish. And she began to realize that there must be something very special about these Jewish people. They must be very spiritual people if they're so interested in pursuing these kind of spiritual paths. And meeting all those Jewish people, ironically, pursuing non-Jewish spiritual paths is what piqued her curiosity and led her, ultimately, to seek the path of Judaism. It's now estimated that about 25% of all of the people practicing Buddhism in North America come from a Jewish background. And not just the practitioners, but the amazing thing is that the leadership and the teachers are phenomenally high in terms of its Jewish representation. Pick up any Buddhist magazine, Tricycle magazine, and Buddhism Today, the number of Goldsteins and Goldbergs and Bluersteins is phenomenal. The people who brought Vipassana meditation to North America were four Jewish people. In Toronto here, one of the leaders of the Sikh community, often appearing on television, is Hari Nam Singh Khalsa, who grew up about 50 years ago downtown in the Kensington Market. His name is David Friedman. If you get some of the leading books today on Buddhism, Lama Surya Das, a nice Jewish boy named Jeffrey Miller from Long Island, one of the leading Hindu lights in the world today, Baba Ram Das is Richard Alpert, and the list goes on and on and on. The irony, the sad irony, is that so much of what they are finding in the East, and so much of what they're attracted to in the East, exists within Judaism. A number of years ago, I picked up a thin book written by one of the great teachers today of mindfulness practice, a South Vietnamese Buddhist monk named Thich Nhat Hanh. The book is called Present Moment, Wonderful Moment, and it presents a series of mindfulness meditations to deal with daily life. They call these gathas. And if you open this thin book, there's a gatha for waking up in the morning, and a gatha for going to the bathroom, and a gatha for washing your hands, and there's a gatha for eating, and a gatha for getting dressed. And if you were to read this book and have a little bit of Jewish sensitivity, you might think that he stole this from a Jewish prayer book. This is something which is not exclusively in the domain of Buddhism. Sadly, though, so many of us don't appreciate the fact that the blessings that we say are there for our spiritual growth. Buddhists in North America and probably throughout the world look forward to the highlight of their life is going on retreat. They save their money. They wait. They might wait months or a year so they can go on a spiritual retreat to get away from their everyday mundane distractions, to be able to go off away from the world, focus on their inner lives. And so many Jewish people are caught up in this cycle of waiting for that retreat. They're going to get to go on and spend 2 or 3 days away from their jobs, be able to focus on themselves, spend $1,000 for it, and we have it every 7 days. It's our Shabbos. We Jews have a spiritual retreat that we are to take every week, and we don't appreciate it. For us, Shabbos becomes a day to fall asleep. And we don't appreciate the fact that it's a day to focus on our internal spiritual growth. So many Jewish people are attracted to the East because of the meditation practices that are offered. I attended a conference in New York a few years ago on Jewish meditation. There were 1,000 Jewish people at this conference. And they were asked, how many of you at this conference ever practiced an Eastern form of meditation? Every hand went up. People had done TM, or Zen, or Vipassana, or Tibetan meditation. The same group was asked, how many people here ever practiced a Jewish meditation? Not one hand was raised. How tragic it is. These people are not aware of the fact that Jewish meditation is as old as the Bible. It's an intrinsic part of Judaism that unfortunately is one of our best kept secrets. We have in Toronto now a number of people, including my wife, who are teaching Jewish meditation practice, and we're finding that Jewish people are seeking this with tremendous thirst. There's no need to travel to India and get dysentery to learn meditation. You do it here in Toronto and the food is better. Roger Kamenetz, who wrote the book, the famous book, The Jew and the Lotus, had a meeting with the Dalai Lama and told him that when he grew up, to him, Judaism was never really meaningful because he saw Jewish practice as simply these commandments and things that you have to do. These commandments. And the Dalai Lama had to say to him, you know, Richard, perhaps you should see these commandments as opportunities for spiritual growth. It took the Dalai Lama to tell Roger Kamenetz, that the word mitzvah probably is better translated as a connector and not a commandment. And so my Kravitz often shares with his audiences, it's the church that translated Torah as law. We translated Torah as light. And if we begin to see our Judaism as a source of light, more so than a source of law, do this and don't do that. These are directions, but to bring us tremendous light and spiritual connection. I think it's inappropriate to point our finger at Jewish people who we see as jumping ship. The old saying goes that when you point your finger at someone, there are three fingers pointing right back at you. The Talmud says to us, Achbara lo ganva chura ganva. The Talmud says with a tremendous amount of wisdom, the mouse is not the thief. It's the hole in the wall over there that no one bothered to repair. That's really where you should point your finger. Don't blame the mouse. All of our Jewish brothers and sisters who are today in churches, in ashrams, in yoga groups, in meditation groups throughout the world, they didn't create that hole in the wall over there. They unfortunately fell through that hole. And if we want to understand the source of our problem, we really need as a community to focus inward, to take inventory. Years ago, we began thinking about our physical health. People started going for screening for colon cancer. We need to do what we call, in Jews for Judaism, a neshamaoscopy. Let's really look at our souls as a community. What kind of homes have we set up? What kind of synagogues have we set up? What kind of community structures and communities have we set up? Going beyond the question of being warm and friendly, that's a big part of it. But can we honestly say that we've created homes that are inspiring, that are passionate? Do we create synagogues where people come into our synagogues and not just are they friendly, but that they see Jewish people worshiping and praying with passion and joy and love for their Creator? Or is it just another boring service that they're sitting through? And when we do this kind of inventory, to me, it's not surprising, or maybe it is surprising, that we're not having more Jewish people elsewhere. I think we need to see these crises that we discussed here tonight as our wake-up call. And there's nothing greater for us as human beings, almost no greater blessing that God ever gave us than the ability to feel pain. The fact that we can be pained by something is a great blessing. If we got burned seriously and our bodies didn't register pain, you would not seek medical help. And the fact that this kind of a program tonight, to hear about all the Jewish people that are being lost to not our community, being lost to their own souls, to Christianity, to Eastern religions, to cults, to intermarriage, we really should feel tremendous pain. I'm sure most of you do. But that pain should move us to action. And I think it's important to understand that you cannot look to Jews for Judaism to solve this problem. You cannot look at your rabbis and your community leaders. Every single person in this room, every member of our community needs to take ownership of this problem. This has to be our wake-up call. We can't simply solve this problem by thinking to ourselves, you know, we'll just give our children some more Jewish education. We'll sprinkle some more Jewish education on our children. That will solve the problem. That is tremendously wrong-headed. The problem here is not our children. I always tell my audiences that when you travel on an airplane, the cabin crew always tells you that if, God forbid, there's a problem, and we got to put those masks to come down as you can breathe oxygen, they always say, you better put the mask on yourself first, then put it on your children. If we think that we can simply sprinkle some Jewish education on our children, we're sadly mistaken. Judaism has to be caught. It cannot be taught. And our children need to come home to our homes to see us as adults who are in love with Judaism. And there was a reason why we chose this name for our organization. We didn't name it Jews Against Jesus. We didn't name this organization Jews Against Buddha. We named it Jews for Judaism because we believe very strongly that unless we as a community becomes a community that falls in love with Judaism and finds the passion to seek the spiritual path that Judaism is and to experience it with joy and excitement and enthusiasm, if our children don't see that in our homes, everything they learn in school will probably just roll off their back. If people coming into our synagogues don't see us, we are the ones that are connected, you're here tonight, see us worshiping with joy and passion and spiritual fervor, why in the world would they come back? It's not difficult understanding why Jewish people have to schlep themselves maybe twice a year to a synagogue. It's a very difficult experience to go through. And whose fault is that? So we have a blessing here tonight. We have it in our hands. We have a problem that pains us. And if we take hold of this problem and take hold of our destinies, we can turn this tremendous challenge into an opportunity. We can see the golden lining, the silver lining behind this very, very cloudy problem, that we can all become Jews for Judaism to create a Jewish community and Jewish homes and Jewish synagogues that radiate joy and passion and spirituality. And I guarantee you, I can assure you, that if we create that kind of a Jewish world, we will not be faced with the problems that we were discussing here tonight. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Skobach. I don't know if some of you are aware, but collectively what you have here in this room is 150 years of experience in countering the missionary and cult threat. That experience is the combined number of years with the Jews for Judaism staff that is present here this evening. We probably have collectively the ability to help a lot of people. But that help cannot be availed of unless you do your part. I asked a few minutes ago, how many of you here know of somebody who's Jewish and believes in Jesus, and 10% of the hands went up. You should know that it is from people like you that we are able to access those people who so dearly need our help. If you know of somebody who is confused about their religious pursuits, they may be entertaining getting involved in a church, they may be possibly involved in one of these business cults that has recently invaded the Jewish community here in Toronto, they may be seeking Buddhism or Hinduism or Islam, or they may be contemplating an intermarriage. We want to help you. We're here to help you. There is no charge. You call, and we'll do the best we can.